papers hold their folded faces to the floor, but every day the Religious Studies Project brings more.
I know it. It's dark, a soft dark side of the moon. Is it breathe is. To me? Speak
is.
To me, breathe. Yeah. Slash, yeah.
That's the one.
Oh, far away across the fields, the tolling of the iron bell brings the faithful to their knees to hear the softly spoken magic spell.
Okay, let's stop that. And of course, in the background in Frankenstein's pub here at the moment, we've got Eric Clapton's Layla.
Derek and the Dominoes.
Was it not the Clapton version?
It's Clapton, but okay. At this stage in his career, he was working as Derek and the Dominoes.
Okay.
So this is by Derek and the Dominoes. Okay. And actually, this end section with the piano was actually written by the drummer. The rest of the song was completed, and the drummer had been playing about in the piano in the studio and started playing this, so they grafted it onto the end.
Interesting stuff. We've talked for a bit here, so we're just going to pass you straight on to Tommy Coleman. He was talking with Kevin Ladd. On the psychology of prayer. Take it away, Tommy.
This is Thomas Coleman for the Religious Studies Project. I'm here with Dr. Kevin Ladd. Dr. Ladd is an associate professor at the University of Indiana, South Bend. He has recently published a book with Dr. Bernie Spilka titled The Psychology of Prayer, A Scientific Approach. Dr. Ladd is a worldwide authority on the psychology of prayer, and he will be speaking with us today on exactly such a subject. Before the interview is over, we hope to answer a few questions, like what is Dr. Ladd doing with a small army of undergraduate researchers, mannequins dressed up like joggers, digital cameras, and a labyrinth. So hopefully we're going to invite Dr. Ladd to connect all of those interesting subjects here before the interview is over. Dr. Ladd, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to chat with you.
Starting out, how did you get interested in studying and researching prayer?
Back in the early 90s, working with Bernie Spilka, we were talking to a group called Reach to Recovery, breast cancer survivors. And in those conversations, we discovered that prayer was something that these folks were citing as being really critical to their recovery process. When we pushed a little deeper into the data, we found that a significant percentage of the people who said that they were praying as part of their recovery also said that they were atheists. And we said, now here is an interesting puzzle. What exactly does it mean when an atheist also checks a box and says, I pray on a regular basis? Mm-hmm. Before we wanted to jump into that, though, we started looking into the literature to see what does it mean to pray at all from a psychological perspective. And we found that there weren't a lot of really great references to tell us what it meant when a believer says that she or he prays. And so we said, well, maybe we should figure out what a believer means first. That's got to be easier than trying to figure out what an atheist means. And so now, 20-plus years later, we're still working on the believer side, not having completely satisfactorily nailed that down. But we do have some research that's starting to pop up now on atheists and belief and prayer. And so we feel like over the last quarter of a century or so, we've made a little progress, but we still haven't gotten back to that first question.
Is there such thing as a prayer in general, or how do we define prayer from a research perspective, if that's even possible? Is there a common definition?
At this point, there are multiple definitions, and most every study that we run into is going to have some kind of a unique definition by itself. And so we don't have an overarching picture for the entire field at this point. There's not like a quintessential source that everybody goes to and says, we're going to start here. I'm not sure the extent to which that would ever happen, or the extent to which it is even desirable, because there are so many different samples from which we're drawing, so many different populations we're trying to address, both within where most of the research is taking place in a Christian tradition, but also outside that. As I mentioned, starting to get into what does it mean for an atheist to pray, to have a secular form of prayer. Is there such a thing or not? And so for each of those samples to have discrete or very tight definitions within particular studies has its own utility for us.
Why is prayer important to research? How is the social scientific study of religion benefiting for research on prayer? What is it adding?
I think one of the key reasons that it's important to look at is because we've just got so many people, especially in the United States, who are saying that they're doing it, right? If we've got over 90% of people say they do anything, it's going to be interesting in some way, just to try to tag down and understand the nuances that are associated with that particular behavior. And so from a purely numbers sort of a point, lots and lots of people are doing it, and so psychologists ought to be in the mix trying to figure out what it means.
What kind of questions can we answer with science regarding prayer, and what can we not answer, or perhaps are not appropriate to answer with science?
This is a really critical sort of a question, and it's one that is incredibly blurry in a lot of the literature, because there's a constant temptation for researchers who are on one side or the other personally of the issue about engaging or not engaging in prayer to slip over into things that become more apologetic in nature than they are scientific. And this is very, very challenging for the field, because it's hard to always have all of your own assumptions and biases right smack in the middle of the table. And as a field, it's incumbent upon each of us to sort of call each other to task and, you know, sort of hold our collective feet to the fire and say what we're really trying to do is we're trying to investigate prayer as a psychological phenomenon, but one that also has a theological sensitivity to it. So in other words, if we want to understand or we want to talk about how it is that people engage in prayer, we have to understand their motivations for starting. And those motivations are coming out of theological traditions. And so we have to figure out ways that we can understand the depth and complexity of those theological traditions or the reasons that people pray, but then talk about those reasons in terms of behavior, in terms of motivation, in terms of affect, things that are classically psychological, and we have to be able to steer clear of making metaphysical sort of assumptions. So, for instance, we can't start out our work and say, our purpose is to show how it is that prayer is effective in changing affect. Mm-hmm. Right there, you know, we've got that immediate bias, and we've got to be very careful with our own thinking and with our writing to make sure that we come across and let people know the field is incredibly mixed at this point. There's good research, there's bad, it's all being published, and we've got to sort through it critically.
So essentially, there's a danger of oftentimes committing self-fulfilling prophecy, specifically yes. When we're looking at prayer. We find exactly what we thought we would because that's what we wanted to find. So.
And I don't think it's any worse in the topic of prayer necessarily than in other places. Sure. I mean, if you were really sold, for instance, on optimism or positive psychology sort of as your framework, you really want people to understand and get behind that, there's just as much danger that you can become an apologist for something like positive psychology as it is for something like psych of religion or prayer. So, you know, it's across the board, but it's something we do need to watch.
You spoke about how hard it is to really define or put a label on the contents of prayer, but are there different types of prayer from a research perspective that you've been able to uncover, take a look at?
Certainly. This is a quintessential way in which people have investigated prayer for a very long time in terms of trying to say, what are the different ways that people engage the practice? Prayers of thanksgiving or of petition or these different categories of prayer. The slippery part here, of course, is that most all of these techniques are going to be using factor analysis as approach or this way of dividing up people's responses. And factor analysis has a certain sort of artistic sense to it as well. There are so many different ways to divide up the human experience of prayer that you can spend your entire life just coming up with different systems. One of the things that we have tried very hard to do in our own research program over the last 20 or so years is we've got one particular way that we've divided these ways of praying up, and we've tried to utilize that in a programmatic series of investigations. We don't make any sort of claims that ours is the best way to divide up the categories of prayer, or it's the only way, nothing definitive like that. But what we have done pretty carefully is tried to show here is how this specific way of dividing things up works in case A or case B, topic C. And by doing that, with this programmatic approach to the research, we've got one set of scales that then we can sort of attack collectively as a friendly sort of a group.
Mm-hmm.
We can say, is it working across these different domains or not? And if not, then how do we develop a better way of categorizing? So much of psychoreligion, as you're well aware, happens as one-off studies.
Yes.
You get one piece that says, this is the way to do it, and then you never hear about it again. We're working really hard to sort of change that approach by having this series of studies.
What's more important, perhaps, the content of a prayer or the frequency at which one prays?
Very good question. Frequency is probably the most common kind of a measure that's used. So if you flip open your book and you start looking for psych of prayer kind of things, mm-hmm. frequency of prayer is all over the place, largely because it's a single item measure. It's very quick. You get an understanding. But we've argued in a couple of places that frequency is not a terribly good measure. It's like if you go to the physician and the physician asks you, how often do you exercise? You can say, oh, I exercise every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But to you, exercise may mean moving yourself between the sofa and the refrigerator. And to the other person, it may mean doing freehand rock climbing. Okay. Just saying that you do something with frequency really becomes a pretty poor kind of an index of what's going on. We know that something's happening, we got no idea. It could also be that when you frequently pray, there's a country western song that I just love as an example here. It's called "I'll Pray for You,"
mm-hmm.
and the person begins and says, the preacher told me I should pray. I don't know how I feel about that since you broke my heart, but trust me, I'll pray for you. I'll pray that your brakes go out on an icy hill, et cetera, et cetera. And so the frequency of prayer, the content can just be all over the place. And so we tend to pull back and we say we need to look at content because then we know more about what's actually going on. Is it a prayer of blessing or a prayer of curse? These are critical sort of questions that we can only get at by content evaluation.
You've spoken a little bit about taking some cues from theology and your scientific research on prayer. I was wondering if you could touch upon integrating some of these theological concepts. Why did you have to do that, and how have you benefited from that in researching prayer?
I would probably not say that we are integrating. I mean, that within psych of religion, that's got a very specific sort of a connotation that brings with it.
Perhaps informing.
Yes. I'll go with the word informing. Okay. Right. What we really try to do is we try to see, why is it that people start to pray? As one example here, we get a lot of research that is looking to link prayer and healing.
Mm-hmm.
What we want to do is first we've got to understand the theology that's behind this. Do people really, is it their base, their fundamental belief that when they pray, physical healing will take place? And for some groups, this is definitely the case. They think, if I pray like this, in this particular way, God will give healing. But other groups say, if I pray, for instance, for my grandmother to be healed, but she dies, that doesn't mean that my prayer for healing was ineffective because it brought grandmother and I together more closely. And so there are all of these nuances that we have to first understand the particular sample with whom we're working and how it is that they understand what they are doing. That then changes very radically the kinds of questions that we ask. So, for instance, for some people, it's going to be just not part of their theology to ask them to lay hands on somebody and pray for physical healing to take place immediately. It just doesn't work. But the kinds of questions that we see being asked frequently don't take into account theology at all. And so it's not an integration approach where we're trying to have a theological psychology of religion, but instead we want one that understands and is sensitive to the actual sample with whom we're dealing. It's sort of a cultural kind of an idea, I suppose.
Certainly seems like any mechanic working on a car would want to look at a diagram and understand how it's done first. So I guess you're saying there's certainly a fair amount of research in the social scientific study of religion that kind of needs to consult at times and understands the theological aspects in order to take apart or take a look at the motor.
Yes, I like that analogy very much. That was you said it much better than I did. Well done.
At the beginning of the interview, you spoke about atheists talking about that they were praying. And as you're well aware of, many times in the field, we're comparing religion with non-religion, something that it's already not, that we've decided. And that's that we've decided it's not, and that's really not much of a comparison. And there's been calls for secular sources to compare certain religious beliefs or, you know, even prayer, for instance, with. Is there a secular source for prayer or something, kind of a non-religious prayer, if that's not a contradiction in terms, perhaps?
Yeah, this has become a pretty hot topic in some ways. I mean, we've had some pieces in the Washington Post, the New York Times that have been looking at atheist prayer, and some of the responses there have been interesting to see the divergence within the atheist community about who is allowed to call oneself an atheist and who is not, right? It's like, excellent, they've got the same problem that fundamentalists anywhere have. Mm-hmm. Right? So trying to identify some particular secular source, I think, is one of the sort of the brass rings that people are starting to look for right now. We don't have a really good piece to answer that question yet, but it's definitely something people are trying to find. They're saying, you know, is humanism sort of a basis that we can talk about some of these perspectives? Sometimes folks will also flip over and they've tried appropriating more Eastern kinds of philosophies and practices and saying, well, these don't look classically religious, certainly in a theistic sense, and perhaps these are sort of the models that we need to develop. Those are some of the pieces that are underway, but no concrete answers yet.
In your research, what are some differences you may have found in prayers, perhaps between males and females? Do females pray more often, pray less? Does the content vary? Do males pray more often? Are there any sex differences?
Yeah, we've been pretty surprised that we haven't seen a lot of sex differences emerging. We anticipated that there would, in fact, be. But in terms of duration and frequency and even in content, we see some variations in terms of content, but not consistently enough that I would say that it's a strong pattern across all the samples. You look at things like attendance and participation in religious services and stuff, and you're sort of off the charts in terms of women who are there, the lack of men. But in terms of the practice of prayer, it seems like this may be something that's more portable. And so although it may not be taking place in a regularized sort of environment, you know, a particular day of the week when the services are underway, it looks like men and women sort of carry prayer with them as one kind of a spiritual discipline they can do wherever and whenever.
So certainly prayer is not just limited to a synagogue or a church or a mosque.
It's
really an anywhere activity that anyone can do.
Right. And it seems to branch across the sexes as well. So it's sort of an equal access kind of thing.
Are there differences in age, for instance, amongst people who start praying at a very young age versus those who may be later teens or later in life? Does the content difference differ? Are there any age differences from when someone starts praying?
Well, we have certainly seen that there are we've been tracking this. Let me back up a little bit. We've been tracking this across a whole bunch of different samples. And so we see that sort of on average across these different samples, people are talking about what's going on in terms of their prayer life beginning around 4 or 5 years old, which, you know, maps on very nicely with, you know, the beginning of school and the ability to reason and think differently and such in terms of a cognitive development perspective. What we do see also, though, is that there's another group of people who tend to report praying guess when, right? In early adolescence. And so here you can think all the way back to the beginning of Psych of Religion and one of the very first studies ever with E.D. Starbuck on adolescent time period as the moment of conversion. And we see so that these two pieces, right? So we've got a socialization kind of an influence that's going on very young, and then a conversion influence. What sort of differences do we see here? Well, we see that, for instance, the folks who come to praying later in life, the adolescent conversion sort of moments, these people tend to have a greater depth of intensity about them, and they tend to use a broader range of ways of praying. The younger folks tend to sort of get into, it looks like a groove, and they sort of figure out what kind of praying they're going to be doing, and that carries with them across their trajectory. Whereas the other folks who come to it later, sort of, it's more like walking into a candy shop for them, and they see all this wide variety of different ways that they could do this, and they tend to really go at the practice of prayer with a lot of gusto and soak up everything they can.
With the whirlwind course of the psychology of prayer we've just kind of gotten, how do you integrate all of these themes, like undergraduate researchers, mannequins dressed up like joggers, digital cameras, and a labyrinth in your own research? What in the world is this going to tell us about prayer? And I'm guessing you have a good answer.
Well, we'd have to clarify, our mannequins aren't dressed like joggers. Okay. They are just basically wearing t-shirt kind of material all over. So it brings on its own different concerns for participants when they see this.
Casually dressed mannequins. Well, please tell us about some of your own research and some of the innovative things that you're doing to take a psychological look at prayer.
What we've been doing most recently is we're trying to get away from the studies of prayer that only incorporate language. So much of what we've done has been on a heavily cognitive kind of a level, talking about linguistics and even content and use of language here. We've started to push beneath that because so much of what goes on in prayer happens at an affective level. It's about an experience that many people will say is beyond words. It transcends. You know, they use all sorts of different positions, but fundamentally what they're saying is, I can't express it linguistically, but there's a feeling. And so what we've been working, for instance, with the labyrinths, is what happens when people are engaging in different kinds of bodily motion when they're at prayer.
And for our, if you'll allow me to interrupt for a minute, for our audience, can you define labyrinth and exactly how you're using it? Is it a maze? And perhaps why is it not a maze?
Yeah. There's a long history of trying to differentiate mazes and labyrinths, but we'll sort of cut to just the contemporary use here and say that when we talk about a labyrinth, it's something that when you look at it, you might think it was a maze, but when you actually begin to do it, you discover that there's actually just a single pathway. There's only one, so you put one foot in front of another, there's one way to get into the middle of it, one way to get out. So you're not going to become lost. There aren't dead ends. There's not false starts. It's a constant sort of a development and a progression from the outside to the middle and from the middle back out. And so that's what we mean when we're talking about a labyrinth. Many different shapes and sizes and configurations thereof, but fundamentally you've got one path in, one out. And so people will use this in a whole host of different techniques. But fundamentally what they talk about is they think about, as they're walking in toward the center, they think about what is their life like now. They get into the middle and they spend a time in quiet meditation and reflection about just sort of being in the moment. And then as they retreat out of the labyrinth, they try to imagine, how is it that I'm going to take that moment that I was just in and help it to inform my life as I re-enter my day-to-day existence? Now, obviously, this can take all sorts of different theological or secular kinds of overtones, and that's one of the reasons we like it, because it does have this very broad sort of appeal. But what we are looking at in particular with it is what happens when somebody's body is involved in that sort of a full bore kind of an experience. When you're not just sitting still or you're not just kneeling stationarily, but instead you're actually physically moving. Does it change the experience for people? So too with the mannequins. Their real purpose is to give people a visual image of different ways that they could use their body while they're praying. So for instance, if they are standing with their hands raised and their heads back, or if they are seated in a lotus type position, or if they're just seated in a regular chair with their hands folded and heads bowed. So when they look at the mannequins, they get a visual image, and then we allow them to take a moment of time to get into that same position themselves and see what the experience of prayer is like in the different physical positions.
So they're actually replicating the position and posture of the mannequin.
Yes, exactly. And so what we're interested in, you know, what is the sort of the visceral, the embodied sort of experience of prayer like, in addition to what's going on in terms of the more higher order processed kinds of material that deal with cognition and language.
Throughout these experiments, are you primarily issuing self-report measures? Do you have them hooked up to certain machines, perhaps measuring neurophysiological response and such things? How are we? What are some things that we're measuring during this?
We're measuring things such as affect. We're measuring, you know, before and after standards. Kinds of research designs. We're also measuring in terms of content and changes in content from what is typically engaged. We have not actually utilized many physiological measures for a couple different reasons, one of which it tends to be pretty invasive in a lot of senses. And so certainly the fMRI research that is out there in terms of, you know, this is your brain on prayer kind of approaches. One of the things that we've discovered in a quick experiment on fMR is that when people are in those contexts and they come out, if you actually debrief them, which if you read the studies on fMR, they're not debriefing folks, so they don't know what people tried to do. But when you do debrief them, they come out and they say, you know, we tried really hard and we weren't able to pray in that context anything like how we normally pray. Mm-hmm. And so we've tried to stay away from a lot of the physio measures at this point because we haven't figured out how to do that without being too invasive.
So you've been able to develop a methodology here that is not as invasive, and I gather is yielding some very significant results in how we understand these things without strapping people up to machines and, you know, shoving them in an fMRI machine, which is certainly kind of a decontextualization from where they would normally pray, as you pointed out. How does the digital cameras and all play into this as well that you're utilizing?
This is another piece where we're looking at the embodied kind of experience of prayer. Within religious traditions, across all of the major ones and even a lot of the minor ones, there's so much visual imagery that's involved in explaining or understanding what's going on within the practice of prayer or the religion more generally. And so we gave people digital cameras, and we asked them to take pictures of whatever they saw in the world around them that was important for their prayer life, what was important to them spiritually. Bring these back, and then we line these up with the ways that they pray. So again, using these categories of praying. And what we're able to show is that people for whom prayer was a very intimate and personal kind of event were also taking pictures that were very close up in nature, so individual petals on a flower or a pebble in a stream. People for whom prayer was a broad sort of a global, I'm praying for world peace and hunger and things of that nature, these people were bringing back pictures of big landscapes with lots of other people in them. So this gave us our first kind of a notion of what's going on between visual experience and spiritual experience. And we're pressing forward with that in a new series of studies that we'll be undertaking starting in December and January of this year and next that use eye-tracking methods to try to parse apart what it is that's going on within the individual pictures. What is it that's capturing the tension? And can those ideas and that sense of spirituality be transferred from one person to another just simply on the basis of visual images? and how does that information move from generation or generation, from group to group of people?
In these studies and a lot of the research you're doing, who are your researchers? Who's really also supporting, contributing to this? From my understanding, you have a small army of undergraduate students that you're able to employ to great success in your research. I was wondering if you could share with us your involvement as a professor, bringing in a group of students who typically don't get a shot at research. Perhaps what is that like, and how has the psychology of prayer benefited from your approach?
This, to me, is one of the greatest benefits that we've seen on a technical side. At the high point, 13 or 14 undergraduates are part of the research team as it rolls along. And what these students are doing is they're memorizing protocols for about five or six different, pretty complex sorts of experiments. So they have to have in their head between 200 and 300 pages worth of protocols that they know. So that they can be pulled from one study and go to another with very little notice. And for them, the experience has been, I think, very, very enlivening. They suddenly realize that they don't have to be at an R1 school in order to really engage in research that is helping to shape and define a field of study. We have a lot of first-generation students on our campus as well. And one of the big things that, as a large faculty, we wrestle with is the encouragement to these students and explaining to them that just because you're the first generation or you're at a smaller kind of an institution doesn't mean that your ideas aren't going to rise to the top, that your abilities are still very good. And many of these undergraduate researchers are leaving the lab with more breadth of experience, from qualitative to quantitative, experimental, non-experimental approaches, than a lot of folks have the chance to get when they're in graduate school. They've had the opportunity to present their work at both national and international forums, places that are not just geared for student research, but they're presenting things on a professional basis. I think one of the high points for some of them was a couple years ago, the International Association for the Psychology of Religion met in Vienna. And some of these students were able to deliver their presentation from the same podium where people like, Sigmund Freud and Viktor Frankl had stood and delivered presentations. And you don't get more intense as a researcher than those sorts of your own visceral experiences.
I definitely hear a recommendation to all the professors, colleagues, and researchers in the field to take advantage and include undergraduate students. Would that be a good thing to do?
Without question. And there's so much within the field of psych of religion that is still at a point where very simple kinds of experiments are incredibly powerful and meaningful. So, for instance, the FMR study that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Very important critique of the FMR literature because they haven't been debriefing, but a very simple kind of a project. An FMR condition, a quiet condition. Just a a counterbalanced two-level condition, but really important for the field.
In closing today, for any students and future researchers who may be listening, what are some future directions that research on prayer needs to go, and some further questions that we need to ask?
This is always the gargantuan question.
it's a lot.
What next? One of the places that we have turned our attention to is looking outside of sort of the typical realms. And I think there's a lot of room to play here for other researchers as well. So just starting up a project right now on the relation between prayer and food. And looking at the interaction when prayer when food stops being a food substance and it starts to be actually considered part of somebody's spirituality, their existence. They've created this loaf of bread and now they're sharing it. It takes on different level of significance. I think there are also areas to investigate here in terms of relation between prayer and music. It's a huge part of traditions. not hardly anything that you've seen out there yet on prayer and music. And then you've got prayer and taste. What's happening, not just with the food, but you know, all of the senses, all of the five senses in prayer. There's so much area to be covered there yet that it's just, you know, it's a big playground yet.
Dr. Ladd, thank you very much for sharing with us today on the Religious Studies Project. And again, if anyone is interested in more of the psychology of prayer, please check out his book titled The Psychology of Prayer, A Scientific Approach. It's available through Amazon. And if you're going to buy it off of Amazon, please use the Religious Studies Project link, and they get a few pennies for every purchase and help support the podcast and the group. So, Dr. Ladd, we thank you for joining us today.
Well, great to be here. It's a privilege and honor, and I hope it's been somewhat useful for folks.
Thank you very much.
So thanks, as always, for that, Tommy.
Yeah.
That's great work, Tommy.
All being well, on next week's podcast, Tommy will be doing the introductions.
I'm just wondering, could we do it so that we have Tommy doing the intro, and then I'm the interviewer? Wouldn't that be weird? It'd be like an inversion of everything that's normal and right in the world.
It would be an inversion. That's not going to happen next week, I'm afraid.
It's
but
a shame.
We might be able to arrange for Tommy to stay for an extra week, just so he could do that the following week.
If you could, that would be great. Yeah. That would be
okay.
Really...
Well, we'll try. You know, it's only Oxford. It's fairly cheap to stay there, and you can just rearrange flights back to the US for next to nothing. You know.
I think so. I think once you've bought a ticket, changing the date and time next, it's easy.
Next week, we've got Jack Tsonis, did an interview with Brent Nongri on his new book, which is called Before Religion, A History of a Modern Concept.
No, so, I'm really looking forward to this.
It sounds like it's really in the sort of school of thought of the Talal Asad, Russell McCutcheon, Timothy Fitzgerald, so it's exactly the sort of thing that really floats our boat.
Indeed, and Jack's really clued up about that stuff as well, you know, and the sort of category construction and post-colonial ideas. And so, yeah, I think this is going to be a cracker. I haven't heard it yet, but it's looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something else I'm looking forward to. It's this year's BASR conference.
Yeah.
Taking place in Milton Keynes, the 3rd to the 5th of September.
It is indeed. We probably should have looked up the conference theme before we started talking, but it's on...
Art.
Yeah.
It's art.
But also on the cutting edge as well, so there's sort of double themes.
Well, the cutting edge thing isn't really a theme, it's more of a sort of thread that runs through it. They're trying to get people who... are approaching religion from other fields.
Yeah.
So that's like kind of a little side thing that's running. But the main theme of the conference is art, defined broadly, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're not sure what we're going to be doing. Yeah.
And we've just come up with an idea for a potential sort of RSP kind of panel, but obviously that's dependent upon the conference organisers, rightly so. So we'll have to keep that under wraps until we have that confirmed, but I'm sure there will be plenty of interviews, roundtables, hopefully the next Christmas special,
which we should probably turn off the recorder and try and work out what that's going to be at some point soon, Chris.
And
but I tell you what I would like to see. I would like to see you and I being the contestants this year. How about an RSP team?
That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
I'd be up for that. That'd I mean, because it's, you know...
I tell you who else is going to be in town. Carol Cusack.
Carol. This is a shout out to you, Carol. I can imagine she might end up being quite a fixture on the show, given that she's coming to Edinburgh in a few months. And we're also thinking of possibly an RSP road trip to Milton Keynes, because we've never done that before.
No, we've never done that before. And if we do, we'll take a recorder with us.
Yeah.
It'll be a bit like the video for Ironic by Alanis Morissette, I imagine.
Okay. I don't get that, but I will get
four,
it in about
four
two
of hers in a car.
Okay.
So,
yeah. That's really all from us.
That's really it, yeah. Google Plus, Facebook, iTunes,
And the Amazons, I forgot to mention, our horde of Amazons.
We've got three now. We've got UK, US, and Canada.
Yeah. So do use them. We're it doesn't take much, but we do earn quite a reasonable sum from that just to keep things going. So from Frankenstein's, from Edinburgh, from the two of us.
Thanks for listening.